Welcome to the More Perfect Union Podcast, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics. Hi, my name is Kevin. I live in Los Angeles. I'm a television writer, and I'm a Democrat, but a centrist Democrat.
Hi, my name is DJ. I'm from Suffolk, Virginia. I'm a cost estimator and economics instructor, self-described economic conservative, and self-confessed Republican.
Hi, my name's Greg. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm a stay-at-home dad. And I'm a liberal Democrat for sure.
And this is Jonah. I am an independent from Maryland, and I work in health and fitness.
And as we always do, we're going to start today's podcast with a couple of headlines from the news. I'll go first. And the one that I'd like to talk about is a headline that appeared in the Huffington Post this morning. And it's about Lawrence Lessig, who is running for the Democratic nomination to be president of the United States. And the headline says, Lawrence Lessig withdraws totally stupid plan to resign presidency. And that totally stupid is in quotes. Now, the backstory here, if you don't know it, and I know the guys do, is that Lawrence Lessig is a Harvard law professor who was running on a platform to remove dirty money or hidden money from politics and to also clean up the electoral system. And as part of his original platform, he had announced that once he accomplishes those goals, he would resign from the presidency, and I guess his vice presidential nominee or his vice president would take over. Well, Mr. Lessig appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher last night, and Bill asked him about this pledge to quit the job or to resign the job as president if he were to be elected and if he were to accomplish these goals. And Lessig admitted it was a totally stupid idea. It's not workable. And he's withdrawn that offer. Now, my point is, and I know one of the guys here has mentioned that he has some admiration. I think it was you, Jonah.
Yeah. Yep.
You've got some admiration for him, and I totally understand. But can you acknowledge that, you know, someone who makes a pledge like that and then himself labels it totally stupid and withdraws it may not be presidential material?
I can agree with that. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that his primary goal of getting, as you say, all the dirty money out and working on campaign finance and all that kind of stuff, I agree with him that you have to get that. And I think the analogy he used on Bill Maher was, we're all arguing about where we want to go on vacation, but nobody has fixed the car. And I agree with that, but perhaps he is not the correct messenger. Perhaps he is not the credible candidate.
If only there was like a 74-year-old white-haired guy who wanted to do the same thing, maybe that would be the right messenger.
You know, I was just thinking the Democratic Party needs another elderly white man to run for office. That's actually what we need, more elderly white people. You're absolutely right.
So let's see. So who's up next on the list? DJ, you want to go?
That would be me, yes. My headline is, no more shock and awe, Jeb Bush now just another presidential aspirant. And this is from the Washington Post. It was from earlier this week. But it mainly focuses on, among other things, just the various stumbles and problems that John Edward Bush is having, and the fact that even though he managed to raise about $13.5 million in the third quarter, he spent about $11.5 million of it. Bringing back that old Patrick Ewing phrase, "We make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money too." What the story describes is what is called the burn rate, which is essentially how much of your campaign money you actually go through in the process. And it was a reminder to me, and it should be a reminder to everybody, that while money is certainly important in politics, candidates who just blow the money on stupid things are still going to lose. You need a decent candidate. You need a decent campaign. And as we have all commented in one way, shape, or form, Jeb Bush is neither a good candidate nor does he have a good campaign. I mean, he was stumbling all over himself this week, and we can talk about that later. But I just thought it was an interesting way of trying to examining what happens when the favorite is no longer the favorite, because he keeps stepping on his own rake, as the Russians would say. And this is just another example of that.
Well, right. I think a lot of the article, if you read between the lines, he has some of the best people working for him, but these guys have been around since his father's campaign also. And they ain't cheap, but they know the political landscape. And they know how to get their message out, but they ain't cheap. And he's been funding this race for quite a while. And he had to cut a lot of money out of their salaries at this point if he wants to stay in. He has a very experienced campaign staff, and they've been around for a while. But like you said, he doesn't have the best campaign, but he's got a really good campaign staff. And he's
amazing. Well, here's the thing. Yeah. You said, Greg, that they've been around for a while. And honestly, as someone who has seen a bunch of Republican campaigns up close and personal recently, that may actually be part of the problem, that they have been around a while. There was no social media when Jeb's dad was running. There was hardly any social media when Jeb's brother was running the first time.
Yeah, back in 2000, you're right. There was no Twitter.
So we're dealing now – we've got essentially a 20th century campaign staff trying to run a 21st century campaign. I myself saw, you know, there's a lot of talk about what happened in 2012 and why the result turned out as it did. I watched the British election this spring as well, where really the two top Obama campaign staffers, and staffers, not give either of them credit, David Axelrod and Jim Messina, actually went on opposite sides. Axelrod went with the Labour Party, and Messina went with the Conservatives and David Cameron. And Messina essentially cleaned – I mean the Conservatives cleaned Labor's clock in that election.
Yeah,
and it was a lot of the things that Obama did well from a technical – the Obama campaign did well from a technical perspective, particularly an IT perspective. The Conservatives also did well. Messina brought with him across the pond, as they say. There really isn't any Republican not candidate who is focused on any of that. And – would you tell me about Bush's staff and that, oh, he has people from his father's days? When I hear that, that's actually part of the problem. That's not part of the solution. We Republicans need a 21st century campaign. We still don't have one.
That's true. And there are two other things to remember when we're talking about campaign finances. First is the burn rate is relative to what you're burning that money on. If you're spending your money on putting into place ground organizations that are going to expand your ability to win caucuses and primaries through the 50 states, that's a good investment. If you're spending it on charter jets and expensive ad campaigns and advisors who may or may not be worth the money, that's a totally different thing. So it's not just the burn rate, but where these people are putting their money. For instance, my understanding is that Hillary Clinton is spending money pretty quickly, but she's putting it into her ground organization, which I think is where these things tend to be won or lost. Another thing to remember is we're talking about what's been reported to the FEC as, you know, money that's going into the campaigns. That's a separate issue from the super PAC money, which is huge, much more than these campaigns are taking in from regular donors. And the balance shifts quite a bit when you factor in the super PACs.
Yeah, but super PACs generally, I mean, let's face it, in the modern era, what super PACs basically are, they're gigantic TV purchasers. That's really most of what they do. And the impression that I've gotten from the little that I've seen of this is whoever's buying at least Bush's ads, I'm not talking about on the Democratic side, whoever's buying Bush's ads, they're not getting a very good return on their investment. He has hardly moved out of the margin of error from where he was, if he's moved out of the margin of error of all, in the states where they actually have put up money to talk about how supposedly wonderful he is on TV. So yes, super PACs can they can essentially create a large cost avoidance for an actual campaign, because in theory you don't have to spend much on TV. But again, you know, from what I've seen of the 21st century, TV is becoming increasingly passé.
Yes, that's right. True.
Thanks to the DVR, and thanks to people know how to skip them. So,
and also when you can't coordinate, and it boggles my mind that these people aren't just talking behind the backs of the FEC, even though they're not supposed to be, you know, the people that work for the super PACs are not supposed to be talking to the people in the campaigns. It's hard for me to believe that they don't. But, you know, from everything that I'm seeing, it seems that the super PACs are sort of treading water and splashing all around, trying to figure out what they should be doing. And the perfect example is the Biden super PAC that put out this ad or created this ad that talked about the loss of Beau and the loss of his first wife and daughter in 1972. And Biden immediately said, I don't want to use that ad. You know, they must have spent $2 to $3 million on that ad and made some purchases too, some ad time purchases. So the super PACs sometimes are spending money but not really spending it wisely.
Yeah, I remember when George Bush the Elder actually sued the people behind the Willie Horton ad to get it off the air. Mm-hmm. But there's a trick with that kind of denial. It's the, oh, you know, that's such a powerful and hard-hitting and emotional ad, and it got me all this great support, but, you know, I would rather you stop. It was like the Johnson-Daisy ad from 1964.
Right,
you only
right.
had to air it once.
Right.
Once you air it once, and then you can stick yourself at as many arms as you can find and put them all between you and that ad. Doesn't matter. Cat's
that's
out of
right.
the bag.
Right. That's you right. Can, with cable news.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cable news, I mean, MSNBC runs these ads that get pulled all day long.
Exactly.
So, okay, who's up next?
I think I am. And we all have heard this one. And this has been running on everything. But the Washington Post, I took it from trusted name. He claimed to be an ex-CIA and was quoted as an expert on Fox News. Prosecutors say it was a lie. And I love this story. I love it because it's just so funny. And if you read the article, one of my favorite lines was he kept repeating. let me find it. No one questioned it. And every time someone questioned whether he actually worked for the CIA, he'd say, you know, I can't prove that because it's confidential or you're not allowed to ask that. And I could actually see this as some sort of ridiculous TV show where he just gets in more and more trouble. And he goes, you're not allowed to ask. But he was getting government contracts for doing this. Mm-hmm. And the more lies, by repeating these lies, they were becoming true. And he was then getting actual security clearance. I mean,
What is his real background? How did he get there in the first place?
To be quite honest, they're still trying to find out because the Navy... he claims his biography goes back like years and says, you know, he was in the Navy and blah, blah, blah. The Navy doesn't even say he was not even in the Navy. And all his neighbors were like, you know, he was so good, but he would always start opening up and then say, you know, this is top secret. I better not talk about the time I was in Marrakesh. Oh, I've said too much. I mean... fascinating. And yet I see these guys on all these shows who are terror experts or, you know, experts in this and this, and we don't know who they are, you know, and it's just
that's true.
You know, and you
there
know,
was some guy at the EPA. He'd been at the EPA for some 20-25 years. And then at some point he actually told them that he was an undercover CIA operative. And he would basically use that as an excuse to just disappear and not show up at his office for like 6 months at a time.
I remember
he was on a mission.
Oh, and, yeah. I remember, you know, this guy.
This is just one of those ha-ha events of a rather, in my opinion, rather deeper of the deeper disease, if you will, in that we really don't know what our intelligence community is doing. You know, they're a lot like the offensive line. You only notice them when they throw a flag. So you only notice the intelligence community when they make a mistake.
Right.
And well, unfortunately for us, they've made a lot of big ones over the last 15, 20 years.
Sure.
But we need to be – this is just another reminder that we really do need to be more observant and more watchful of these folks and find out what they are actually doing and where it's a situation where they can't – you know, try to find out, make sure that they can be – we can have as much disclosure as possible – without creating, you know, the obvious threats and dangers that come from it. But I think we as a country, and you know, you saw this with the Frank Church hearings. You know, the Frank Church hearings went on in 76, and the first chance the voters of Idaho had, they sent Frank Church into retirement as soon as they could. You know, anybody who was part of that hearing, like the voters basically turned their eyes and said, okay, you're retired. This is one of those conspiracies that now has 300 million co-conspirators because we're all in on it and we all want to pretend that the intelligence communities get everything right and that we don't need to know what they're doing. That ain't true, folks. We need to know a lot more about what they're doing, or we're going to keep having guys like Wayne Simmons who say they're CIA and we just let it go because we want to believe them.
Well, here's like coming back to why this particular story is so upsetting is that this man was on Fox News giving expert analysis, and now he's been proven to be a fraud. But the people who saw him give this expert analysis, which clearly was, you know, often, you know, tilted against the administration and I'm sure against Democrats and pro-Republican, the people who need to know that will not find out because they're never going to give this story on Fox News.
Well, that's not true. There was an apology Friday night. One of the shows that he was on, Will Cavuto. Neil Cavuto, thank you.
Cavuto.
One of my least favorite people. Actually apologized, and he said, I should have had higher standards, I should have checked his background, and I should have... and, you know, this is something, it'd be real easy for me to jump on Fox and say, look, Fox is evil, Fox is ridiculous. But it's I haven't been. Because I'm sure MSNBC and CNN has like tons of these guys also who as long as they say what they want to hear, they're going to be back.
Well, you know? Greg, in response to your magnanimity in leaving Fox News alone,
sure.
I'm actually going to skewer them a little.
I find it
interesting that the apology was issued on Friday night, which is when everybody else likes to dump bad news. And there's a stereotypical joke about high school football games and who would watch them and who wouldn't.
Right.
But I think that writes itself.
Yeah.
So
and wasn't
I
there
was
also
simply...
a Major League Baseball playoff game on at that time?
I believe there was.
No one watches baseball. Come on. I think.
So.
Yeah. Oh well.
Well, it's great to hear both of you being magnanimous about Fox one way or the other. and with that, Jonah, you want to throw in your headlines?
Yeah. So I saw something this week that reminded me of something from a year ago. So I'm going to connect these two things. This is how I sort of reference the news sometimes. A year ago, the UN put out a press release saying that we had basically we were on track to completely fixing the hole in the ozone. And here was my thought process. So. In the 80s, there was this early emerging science came out. There's a hole in the ozone layer. We're all going to die. We have to fix it. And Reagan was president. And his perspective was, is this really good science? Well, no, it's early. And then, but his approach was, well, maybe these people don't know what they're talking about. Maybe this is weird, but we should have a contingency plan. So he participated in an international organization to help deal with the hole in the ozone layer. And all the conservatives said, but this is going to destroy our economy. We're interfering with business. We're doing all these horrible things. And we don't even believe in this science. And Reagan said, well, just figure it out just in case. And it turns out that there was a hole in the ozone layer. And because, in large part, because we participated with this organization, we've now... we've basically fixed it, and it won't be completely done for a couple years now, but we've gotten all the products out. Like, there's large international cooperation here. So this week, CNBC put out an article called Sucking Carbon Out of the Air and Making Money, wherein this article talks about a couple of companies that have figured out how to pull extra carbon out of the air that is contributing to climate change. And these two companies are figuring out how to make a profit from it. And one of them – and they're not fully solvent yet, but one of them is starting to sell this carbon to farmers to use in greenhouses. And another – the other company has gotten a grant to start fueling public transportation and buses based on the carbon that they're pulling out of the air. And the punchline is that these are not American companies. That one is from Canada and one is Swiss. And because we were in a very similar situation where we maybe don't believe in the science, maybe climate change isn't happening, the difference was that we didn't want to participate, and we're kind of leaving it up to whoever that wants to get involved can get involved. And that now means that there are other companies, private companies throughout the world, that are at the forefront of figuring out how to make money by fixing climate change. And we're not quite there. So for me, the connection was there's definitely a change in just one more piece of evidence as for why the climate and the partisanship is not good for this country.
Well, I would say, because I remember, one of the first things that I got involved in politically was a 1987 state legislative election. And that really had nothing to do with the Montreal Protocol itself, but that actually was signed the same year. And what Republicans were basically told was, hey, look, Reagan waited to sign this until there was a marketable alternative to chlorofluorocarbons that was more efficient, that was better at what it did, and would not create the issues that chlorofluorocarbons did. And for a lot of – and in fact, that's largely what happened. Chlorofluorocarbons got essentially wiped out of the market by whatever the alternative was.
Yeah.
Now, the issue with this – and I've said this – well, I've said it before, but I haven't said it here. The biggest problem – that the global warming community has had so far, particularly in the United States, is that the science is not quite as firm as they think it is, particularly on carbon sensitivity. That is actually all over the map. And the science doesn't actually speak to policy. It doesn't say that an emissions trading scheme is superior to a carbon tax, and that's largely because it's not. In fact, the Stockholm Environmental Institute did a study on the European Union's carbon and trading emission scheme and found that Russia and Ukraine gamed the system so badly it actually increased the emission content. Canada signed the Kyoto Accord in 1997 and then completely ignored it. It was actually a rather huge joke in every campaign since then. That said, I think Jonah does have a point in that we have become, in this country, so divided and so tribal that we're no longer in the situation where we look and go, that's something that might be an issue. Is there a way that I can solve that in a market-friendly way? Nobody on my side of the aisle is really even asking that question. They're so locked into opposing the left and center-left's proposed solution to the problem that they go so far as to just challenge the problem rather than say, wait a minute, we can come up with a better way to solve the problem. Now, whether or not global warming is a problem or isn't a problem depends on how much you trust temperature data, and I'm not going to get into that now because it'll take forever.
I was going to say, we only have so much time.
Right, we only have so much time. But I think Jonah is right in that we spend so much time arguing with each other that we don't borrow each other's thinking anymore. In the rest of the country, people steal each other's ideas politically all the time and then give it a little twist to make it more sellable to their side of the political spectrum.
That's how we got Obamacare.
That's true.
Basically, we left the individual mandate on the side of the road because we didn't want it anymore, and then you picked it up 15 years later.
And then we got it.
We saw it at a garage sale, dusted it off, and here we are.
Right.
So with that in mind,
with capitalism can solve all the problems.
Every single one.
And we've learned that.
What a perfect segue to the discussion of the events of this week. There was a Democratic debate, the first one. It was in Nevada. And I'd be curious to start with DJ, being that you're on the conservative side of the ledger and not necessarily going to vote for one of these candidates, although I suppose you could. But I'd love to hear what your take was on the debate.
Well, There is a part of me that wants to say that Jim Webb was the only candidate who seemed to be anchored in reality, but he was a senator of mine for 6 years, so I know that's not true either. To be less snide about this, this was what I found interesting was essentially it was a race to the left. That was seemed to be much of the discussion about how far the candidates felt they needed to go to the left. Obviously, Bernie Sanders won the race. Hillary Clinton, I think, stopped right at the discussion of Denmark, which is funny because Denmark isn't really what either of those two think it is, but that's an entirely different discussion. But, you know, it was a reminder really of how unexciting the Democratic field really is. I mean, these are the five candidates that minus Larry Lessig that the Democrats have. Rhode Island's last Republican United States Senator, that's Lincoln Chafee.
Yeah.
Reagan's Navy Secretary, that's Jim Webb. A governor who was so thoroughly incompetent that when his lieutenant general ran as his heir apparent, the voters of his own state elected a Republican instead. That was Martin O'Malley. And Bernie Sanders, who has done a wonderful job in explaining how government is designed to help every single poor rural white person in northern New England to the complete ignorance of everybody else.
And he's not really a Democrat.
No, he's not.
He's not.
Are we really surprised that Hillary Clinton, who has been elected twice from a state with a larger population than the home states of all the other four candidates combined, I did the math on that one, and who has served 4 years as Secretary of State and who's actually done national presidential debates, a whole bunch of them in 2008, is it really a surprise that she did as well as she did and that she was acknowledged as the winner by just about everybody except the Twitter bots? No, that's not a surprise at all.
I'd love to talk about that for a moment because obviously it's subjective as to who won, but clearly the media and the experts and the political experts seem to come down very heavily on the side that Hillary Clinton had given the more polished, more impressive performance. But for those of us who spent any time on Facebook or Twitter or the other social media this week, we know that the Sanders people flooded the internet immediately after. They didn't even wait for the end of the debate. They were about 20 minutes into the debate when they started declaring him the winner based on online flash polls, which are notoriously the least accurate form. I mean, American Idol has a more stringent voting system than most of these online polls. And what I found fascinating was the debate about who won the debate, and I'd love to hear what you guys think about that.
Well, I mean, it wasn't really – I mean, on several points, Bernie Sanders could have – you know, I heard the video game call, "Finish her," and he stopped, and he said, no, I agree with her. We're sick of these emails, and at several times, I mean – he could have won the debate. He could have, you know, said, yeah, let's hear about this. And I think you're wrong. But he didn't. I mean, on these aspects alone. And then when it came to gun rights, I mean, he had terrible answers. So, no. I mean, I think when you said, you know, polished political, you know, aficionados, I think, like ourselves, I think we all agree she won. I mean, yeah.
So I'm gonna after the debate, my feeling was that it was roughly a tie. And I've sort of have tried to figure out why I feel that way. And I think that I've kind of clarified my thought here. And that was that what Sanders was able to do was speak to the people that were passionate about him and cement their support. And what Clinton was able to do was sort of, stop the hemorrhaging of her losses, maybe her poll numbers and things like that. And maybe some of the undecideds and maybe some of the Biden people are now going to go to her. But I don't, when I think of who won a debate, I sort of feel like that means that someone else lost. And I don't think – maybe Biden lost just from not being there. But between Sanders and Clinton, I don't think either of them lost. And I know that the gun issue – that Sanders' gun issue there is significant for some people, and it wasn't for me. For me, it was very much that he was talking to rural gun owners, rural law-abiding gun owners, and that to me was communicated. And Clinton was talking to sort of the urban lefties who just don't want any guns at all. And I think that they were talking sort of cross purposes there, I guess. But I don't know. I think that she won insofar as she didn't lose. And same thing with Sanders.
I would say, first of all, I could lose three fingers on my right hand in an industrial accident, and I could still count on that hand the number of rural gun owners who will vote in a Democratic primary. So, yeah. Frankly, you know, Bernie may have been talking to rural gun owners, but he something should have clicked in his head that they're not going to be the ones voting in his primary anyway. Yeah. Secondly, when the best night you have as a candidate is essentially putting a piece of cast plate armor on someone else who's on the stage, you lost. Bernie seems to think that he can run by – that he can – if he thinks he can win at all, he thinks he can win by being the left-wing alternative to Hillary Clinton. That's not how you win the Democratic primary. You win – by being the clean alternative to Hillary Clinton. And he basically chucked that opportunity away.
Well, that was Lincoln Chaffee's approach. You know, I am the only candidate here with a clean bill or a clean record. And I'm proud of that. Thank you.
Yeah, he is also on that stage, the only candidate who has actually won an election as a Republican.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, it was. Did anyone see the Wolf Blitzer interview with him?
No.
Yes.
I mean, was it Thursday? Was it Friday?
I saw Blitzer talking to him. I don't remember. What
yeah, Wolf. First of all, Wolf Blitzer can't play Jeopardy. I'm going to bring that up because Wolf Blitzer got beat by Andy Richter on Jeopardy, and I'm going to say this because Wolf Blitzer's not a nice person because of how he treated Lincoln Chaffee in this segment. He's like, you know, you're embarrassing yourself. And he would ask, and he goes, no, I don't think so. And he goes, no, you were up there. You were just getting hammered. And he goes, so when are you going to drop out? Because you're not doing anything. You're not making millions of dollars and you're not doing anything. So when are you going to? It was horrible. I felt bad for him. I might vote for him out of pity now. I mean, after that, I'm not. But it was rough.
Well, I will shed a tear for my friend Link. But going back to the more established candidates that were on the stage,
sure.
What I find it fascinating is when Elizabeth Warren, there was some noise about that she might get into the race. And the liberals in the Democratic Party were very excited because they felt that she would at least pull Hillary Clinton toward the left. Then when she decided not to run and Bernie Sanders sort of filled that void, that gap, that was still the basic thing of, you know, early on when we're talking about May, June, maybe even into early July, people said, well, of course, he's probably not going to win, but at least he can help pull Hillary to the left. Now, 3 months later, he has very successfully pulled Hillary to the left, and the Sanders people are upset with Hillary Clinton for moving to the left. And I don't understand why these people are upset at her for adopting the positions that they believe in. Now, I know that they think that she is co-opting his positions, and maybe they are dubious about her authenticity or the true, you know, essence of her move to the left. But they seem upset because she's being a Democrat.
Oh, I know why. I can tell you why. Because Bernie Sanders voters and the people who they don't like to win. And I'm not kidding here. This is a great, and I know this is going to be my first batch of hate mail, and that's fine. This is a group of people who love to be the underdog. They're contrarians. You know, if they're not being oppressed, and if they're not being, these are the guys who just love it when, you know, I just love fighting the good fight. But here's a chance to win, and they're going to get everything they want, and it's just going to be awesome, and they're going to mess it up. And why? Who knows? Because it's just not the right color blue. You know, it's not the right shade.
I have seen this movie before. I've seen it twice before. I saw it with both Ron Paul campaigns.
Oh.
And we're seeing it some with the Rand Paul campaign as well. This is a very personal movement, a very personal movement that essentially is heavily overrepresented in social media. And this is how they operate. It's my way or the highway. They only trust one person. It is very, very heavily tribal. And, you know, this is something that has afflicted my side of the political aisle for many years and still is. It's still a problem. It's just manifesting itself differently now. And what we are now seeing is that Republicans and Democrats are both humans, and they both are susceptible to this kind of thing within their group. It is now being shown up as with Bernie Sanders now on the Democratic side. But that also tells us that, you know, just because you have a great social media operation and a number of people on social media who are backing you and pushing you, doesn't mean you're necessarily going to win with actual voters when votes are actually cast. And that's why just about everyone outside social media who has gone through this before and who know the game are looking and saying, well, that's why they're saying Hillary Clinton won. Because when it comes to basically everyone on that stage had to convince the viewers and the Democrats that those viewers will talk to that they should not support Hillary Clinton. And I don't think anybody did that. And so that's why she won.
This actually happened to me also in 2004. If anyone wants to jump in and guess who it was, Howard Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone remembers, Howard Dean was raising small amounts of money, raising it through the internet. He had groups called Dean for America, and they were all heavily invested. And in fact, even after he dropped out, the Dean for America group still would continue. And they were still called Dean for America. And he had these small groups locally, and they were the Dean meetups. And they lasted for years. I mean, I don't know if they.
And what state elected Howard Dean as governor again? Exactly.
Exactly.
And speaking of egg, let's go back to a little further in history to 1952 and 1956.
I am going to put on the website my picture of me and Howard Dean tonight.
How will we know who's who?
It's hard to say. I'm the one not screaming at everybody.
But, you know, a lot has been said about, you know, comparing Sanders and his potential to win were he to get the nomination to Howard Dean, who obviously didn't get the nomination, to Michael Dukakis, to George McGovern, to Eugene McCarthy. The list goes on and on. But I would urge our viewers, I know you guys know about Adlai Stevenson II, but I would urge our listeners, not our viewers, who may not be familiar with Adlai Stevenson, to look him up, Wikipedia or wherever else you can find him on Google, and read up on him, because this guy, to me, is Bernie Sanders about 50 or 60 years ago. And he was he ran twice as the Democratic nominee for president, got slaughtered both times, and to me shares a lot of the same traits, characteristics, and the electoral acumen of Bernie Sanders. I'd be curious if you guys think that that's an apt comparison.
I'm not so sure. Well, part of that – I'm not entirely certain of that because for a couple of reasons. One, if memory serves, Adlai Stevenson was governor of Illinois, which was a very, very big state then, not as big now, but it was a very big, hefty state then. So, I mean, he must have had some political chops to be able to get elected from a state that large, number one. Number two, it was probably easier if Stevenson really was as flaky as Bernie Sanders is now. Probably half the reason he got the nomination was because the Democrats looked over at who the Republicans were running and said, we don't stand a freaking chance. So let's just throw up this guy, which interestingly comes back to what's happening on my side with the continued success of Donald Trump. I'm guessing a lot of that is from a lot of people who are thinking, you know, Hillary's locked down the Democratic on the Democratic side. We think she's going to beat whoever we put up there. So why don't we just have a little fun and put the Donald up and see what happens? There are probably a lot of folks in the 50s who thought that way and thought, you know, let's throw caution to the wind and go with Adlai Stevenson and such. And I'm guessing a lot of the Democratic bosses back then probably went along with it because certainly in 1956, they figured, well, you know, if John F. Kennedy can't get on that ticket, it's probably for the best, and we'll just let things sit and wait. But, you know, like I said, the Eisenhower factor, I think, played a big role in who the Democrats chose to nominate or chose not to nominate, both in 52 and in 56. And that may actually come up again on our side if too many people think that the election next year is unwinnable.
Do you think that's true? Have you been sensing that maybe that's why Trump, or one of the reasons why he's doing as well as he is?
From the impression that I get from folks that I have talked to within the party, particularly at the grassroots level, and particularly in Virginia, which has a very divided Republican Party in general, but the fact that Virginia is essentially the Democrats' firewall swing state, there really is a sense of we're going to blow it again. Even if it was a winnable race, we'll find a way to lose it. And that's assuming it is a winnable race, and I think a lot of folks are not really sure about that either. There is a joke that is very prevalent among conservatives. It's that there are two political parties in America. There are the Democrats and there's the stupid party. And there's a lot of sense among Republicans, particularly among conservative Republicans, that Hillary is unbeatable, not necessarily because of who she is, but because we've got a bunch of Keystone cops running the party and running the various campaigns. And I think that really has fueled a lot of interest in outsiders because, you know, when anybody says, wait, that guy's not electable, the general response is, yeah, well, who is electable among this field?
Well, and you know, it's an interesting theory, but I mean, going into this primary cycle, everything that I heard was that the Republicans had a field of all stars. And I'm not sure how we've gotten from that to the clown car. Jeb Bush was considered this very impressive two-term governor of Florida. John Kasich, a two-term governor of Ohio. Chris Christie, a two-term governor. I don't think that Lindsey Graham, although we make fun of him, I don't think you can say he's not a very viable he's a very viable presidential candidate. And there are several others. Ted Cruz is a senator. Marco Rubio is a senator. So I'm not sure why we would look at this field and say there is no one there that's electable.
It's not that you're looking at this field, and I think this is our chance to segue into what's happening on the Republican side.
Yes.
But the fact that, you know, that Donald Trump's response to Jeb is, well, 9/11 happened on his brother's watch, so it's his brother's fault. And the first thing Jeb says is, well, you know, Trump would blame FDR for Pearl Harbor. You know, I have something of a student of history, and there actually are a lot of historians who will gladly put a lot of blame on FDR and the people under him for Pearl Harbor. So, you know, that sort of rustiness in that regarding Jeb is a reason why he just does not look anywhere near as electable as he appears to. I mean, yes, there are a lot of candidates with a lot of impressive resumes, and I'm backing one of them. But to some extent, they drown each other out, number one. Number two, the party itself has gotten between the acrimony between the establishment and the conservative wings is now so great, and the conservative wing of the party is now so thoroughly tribal, that Donald Trump at this point could say practically anything, and there's going to be at least 1 in 6 to 1 in 5 Republican Party Republican primary voters, or people who say they're going to vote in the primary, they may not actually do it, who will find a way to defend him, because he makes the right enemies, or he makes the right opponents within the party. And that's, I think, is a lot of what you're seeing. Too many Republicans are more interested in scoring points against the other wing within the party than they are in winning the next election.
This last week or so, we've seen some interviews and some op-eds from conservatives and party members saying that if a Republican doesn't win the White House this year, then the party is going to fracture even more than it already has. And I guess my question for you guys is, do you think that's true? And what does a further fracturing look like?
I've said this before, and I'll say it again, and I am the Republican in the group. The only reason the Republican Party even exists in its current form is the ballot access laws. Without the ballot access laws that essentially guarantee a Republican nominee will be on the ballot and will have a major position in the ballot, the party probably would have atomized. They didn't have ballot access laws in the 1850s when the Whigs fell apart. They didn't have ballot access laws in the 1800s when the Federalists fell apart. Traditionally, this isn't just the United States. The Australian right went under several other names. The Canadian right went under a serious restructuring in the 1990s. The British, who had the first original right-wing party, the Tories, renamed themselves the Conservatives in 1835, and every generation after that basically raided various other parties and sort of glommed them into the coalition. This is what happens in the Anglospheric right. They go through some dramatic and what at the time were perceived as radical changes. The ballot access laws are sort of stopping that on the Republican side. And if the party loses next year, and again, I would say Clinton is the favorite over any of the Republican nominees, including my choice, Marco Rubio, then there's going to be first a gigantic argument about why the party lost again. There's going to be an argument about which direction it goes in. And frankly, the people who are not listened to are more likely to say, you know, the heck with it, I'm out, and leave and either try to do something on their own, or some of them, maybe very few of them, some of them will just switch over to Kevin and Greg. That is possible, as bizarre as that sounds. That will happen probably with a few of them, and it will happen a lot more if the conservative wing of the party wins the argument. If the conservative wing of the party wins the argument, then a number of moderate Republicans will probably just switch and say, that's it, I'm done, and become moderate Democrats.
Because they can find Democrats that hold their positions. You can find Jim Webb out there. You know, so if you're a military gun rights guy, you can say, well, there are prominent Democrats that support my position. I guess I do belong there.
That's very true. You're going to see among, and you could very well see, if say the establishment wing wins, you could see a lot of strong economic conservatives who do not really follow the party on social issues saying, wait a minute, is it easier to convince Republicans to go with me on social issues, or to convince Democrats to go with me on economic issues? That could be something that a question a lot of Republicans have to ask themselves in 2017 and 2018, depending upon how the party responds to a defeat. The way we do things in America is if one of the parties loses so often over and over again, they change themselves to match the electorate. That means gaining some people. It means losing other people. And, you know, the Democrats after George W. Bush won in 1988, about half a dozen Democratic congressmen switched over to the Republicans. And there was a lot of talk that, maybe this is a sign that the Republican realignment is finally reaching out past the White House and there'll be the permanent majority forever. And of course, we all know what happened. Okay. When you change yourself to gain voters, you risk losing other voters. And the question is, will the Republican Party choose to do that as Labor did in the early 1990s, as the Democrats did in the early 1990s, as the Canadian Conservatives did in the early aughts, as the British Conservatives did. And it took the British Conservatives almost 18 years to get this right. And they're actually stunned that they did it. I mean, if they had lost the election in May of 2015, then they would say, we went through 18 years trying to change ourselves and it still didn't work. So this takes time. There's going to be the political equivalent of blood on the floor. It means there will be some people who will leave the party because they will not want to see the changes that the party would have to go through if it loses a third election in a row. So I don't know if fracture is the right word, because again, those ballot access laws are still there. But if the Republican Party loses in 2016, they will decide we have to be very different in 2020. And very different means losing some people as well as gaining others. How that party will look in 2020, I have no idea. We need to see what actually happens in 2016 first.
Right. And then the last story that I think we want to touch on in the time we have remaining is the one person who doesn't seem to know whether he wants to run for president of the United States. Can anybody take a guess? Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Vice President Biden.
What do you guys think? Is he in or is he out? Do we ask this every week?
I think he's both. I think he's going to clone himself and do both.
I suspect he will. And the other thing we have to remember about Biden is Biden has been in around since 1972. So he remembers the days when candidates could declare as late as December or even January. Mario Cuomo held everybody in politics waiting with bated breath for him to decide whether he was going to enter the race or not in 1992. He waited until December of 1991 to say no. So I think in Biden's mind, he has more time probably than he really does, and he has more time than anybody thinks he does. My guess is as this moves forward and as Hillary builds on her debate performance and basically cements her position, that he will decide, you know, it's not really time to run. His best option is to be the quote unquote clean alternative to Hillary Clinton. Hillary needs to have mud thrown on her that sticks for that to work. It hasn't happened, and I don't think it's going to happen. And so I think he's going to say he is going to back out and he is not going to run.
I have to say you're right. You know, I had found a tweet from someone earlier, but it turned out to be a hoax. I had actually double checked it before I said anything about it.
Can you tell the listeners what that tweet was?
Nope. Not even going to spread hoaxy rumors because one,
man.
I feel ridiculous saying, "Oh, I just fell for a hoax." And I don't think he's in it. You know, I don't think his heart is, but I think he's going to come out, I'm going to say Monday, tomorrow, before this even comes out, we're all going to say, he's going to come out and say, everyone should vote for Hillary. And as soon as he says that, I think Bernie Sanders is going to come to his senses, because I am this much of an optimist, and say, he's right. Everyone, all my Sanders people, turn around, start voting. Get out there, start working. We got work to do. Mm. And you know, and I'll win the lottery that same day too.
About as good.
Yeah.
I watched one of those draft Biden commercials before the debate, and it reminded me what I like about him, and that when he is on, he can move a crowd emotionally, and yet I didn't feel like. Maybe I was one of the target people because I like him. I think he's a good guy. I think I have good memories of him, but it didn't make me want him in the race. It was just like, oh yeah, I like Joe Biden. Well, on with the debate.
Yeah. And as I tried to explain to my dad, who was born and raised in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and lived in New Jersey his whole life. I said, Dad, Joe Biden, in a lot of ways, Joe Biden is an arrogant blowhard who just says the first thing that comes to his mind. That's us. That's Northeasterners. We love that kind of guy. He speaks his mind no matter what his mind says. The rest of the country looks at us like we just landed from Mars.
He's Peter Griffin from Family Guy.
Yes. Yes. And I'm not sure that America is looking to elect Peter Griffin, although he has had a good run on TV. And with that, I think we probably have to start wrapping up. Any final predictions for the week to come, or who you think might end up being the two nominees of their respective parties?
Hillary, and I think she's going to name – I think she's just going to say, right now, I'm going to name Julian Castro as my VP. She's going to get it out now before anyone else claims dibs on him.
Jonah? Go ahead, Jonah.
No, it hurts me to say, but I think I have to finally say that Hillary is probably going to get the nomination. And I guess I'm still going to go with Rubio because I have no idea what's going on. I can't possibly see Trump, Carson, or Fiorina getting the nomination, so I have to go with Rubio over there.
DJ?
I would say, again, I am fairly confident that Secretary Clinton will win the nomination. On my side, normally I would say Rubio, but however, he is my choice, and usually my first choice in the Republican presidential nomination does not win. So that's sort of holding me back. But the fundamentals still say Rubio, and then I would say again, I would put the secretary to use the football odds terminology, I would put her giving 2 points in the popular vote and giving about 25 to 30 electoral votes in the electoral college.
Okay. And last week when I was asked this question, I said Clinton Rubio. This week I'm going to pull a reverse. I'm going to predict it's going to be Clinton and Trump.
No.
I'm going to be the first, and I hope you guys will welcome me back into sanity if I change my mind again. But I'm looking at everything. I'm looking at the numbers. I'm looking at the money they brought in. I'm looking at all of the negative stories I'm reading about Rubio and Jeb Bush. I don't believe Ben Carson ultimately is going to be electable. By the way, if anybody saw him on this week with George Stephanopoulos this morning.
Crazy.
I think he gave an interview that disqualifies him from being commander in chief. We don't have time to go into the details, but everybody should try to find that online. But at a certain point, we may not be there yet, but at a certain point, these numbers become baked in. And when you're leading, you know, the next realistic possibility by a 2-1 or 3-1 margin, I just don't see how the shift is going to happen. Trump has already put, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 feet into his mouth, and it hasn't hurt him yet. I just don't know what's going to happen between now and February 1st to turn the tide. Of course, it can happen, but I'm going out on a limb and saying that he may just be the nominee.
February, we also have to remember, though, February 1st is usually not when nominees are decided. In fact, if you going back for most Republican campaigns, the winner, someone has won an early state and not gone on to be elected president. George W. Bush in Iowa in 1980, Bob Dole in Iowa in 1988, Pat Buchanan in New Hampshire in 1996, John McCain in New Hampshire in 2000. Huckabee and Santorum in Iowa in 08 and 12. The early states don't quite have the power that we think they do. The big one is going to be in March, and that is enough time. That really is enough time for the 60 to 70% of Republican voters who do not want Donald Trump to be nominated to coalesce behind somebody and say, okay, it has to be this person. Whether they will do that or not, I don't know. So I'm not necessarily going to say that Kevin is wrong, but I am going to say that winning New Hampshire and Iowa by themselves is not enough. And that's all I'll say on it.
That's absolutely correct. And with that, I think we have to say goodbye for this week. Everybody, it's been a great show. For More Perfect Union, this is Kevin signing off, and we'll see you next week.